Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We're streaming live over the video, so you can watch today's program if you choose by going to progressiveradionetwork.com or garynall.com. Just a coming attractions to let you know what we have up. Today, my guest in the second part of our program at 3:30 will be Marilyn Hyman. She is the director of the Pew Environmental Group's Offshore Energy Program, and we're going to ask her about what do we as Americans have to do to get legislation forcing oversight and accountability in offshore drilling, which doesn't seem to exist at all, nor has it existed at any time. So how do we know that we can be protected so that this kind of oil catastrophe doesn't happen again? So that's our discussion there. Tomorrow at this time, we're going to be talking with Tom Engelhardt, one of the nation's most important commentators on America's military adventures and their impact upon our culture and economy. He is the founder of the Nation Institute Progressive blog, TomDispatch.com. And we're going to talk about the war in Afghanistan and the contradictions that we've been told by this government, the last government, the Defense Department, and the talking neocon heads on television, why we can't win this war, and why we shouldn't be there. In effect, this was like Daniel Ellsberg's, who was on here recently, the Pentagon Papers. So we'll explore that. That's tomorrow. And tomorrow at noon, we have Dr. Hans Kugler, one of the pioneers in anti-aging medicine and stem cell research, and we're going to show you how we can reverse the aging process now. And then we have Karen Ranzi on, talking about how we can apply the principles of a healthy lifestyle that we often speak about with adults and children. And children are faced with more health problems than ever before. And why? Why are our kids so sick? So that's just some of the things you can expect. Now to the latest in health and nutrition. As many of you know, I'm a vegan, and this is based upon being in a dietetics class where I was studying to be a licensed dietitian, which I am, and I noticed that all the dietitians were very unhealthy. Then I looked at what they were suggesting for people in hospitals, and I just found it atrocious. And I asked the professor in class, I said, if we're supposed to be having meat or animal proteins three times a day, and you're seeing more and more Americans who are overweight and with high blood pressure and cholesterol and heart disease and cancer, and yet you don't see these in people around the world who have little or no meat in the diet. And he said, well, it's just genetic. I thought that was just about the stupidest answer I've ever heard. So it would be about 10 years later at the Institute of Applied Biology where I was doing research, and in one of those fluky experiments, I found that black beans had all 8 essential amino acids. I thought I'd made an error. So I asked a Dr. Berman. In the morning, I said, I tried an experiment just trying to determine which amino acids and what potency these amino acids were in some black beans, but I made a mistake. Could you double check? And he said, yeah. I didn't tell him what the mistake was. Well, that night when I came back in, I spoke with him, and he said, well, there's no mistake. You were correct. I did the same test, and I thought, well, that can't be. I went to Robinson's Normal and Therapeutic Nutrition, the official textbook that every nutritionist and dietitian studied from, and lo and behold, it said that only animal proteins were complete, meaning containing the 8 complete amino acids, and that all others were incomplete, and fruits and vegetables were only partially complete, meaning you never ate a fruit or vegetable to get protein from it, you ate it for antioxidants. Well, this suddenly showed they were wrong. Over the next year and a half, I did a chemical assay on every single type of food. nuts, seeds, legumes, fruits, vegetables, herbs, all of them contain all 8 essential amino acids. And then I realized that by combining in normal serving sizes 2 or 3 of these together, I could have a higher quality protein, greater net protein utilization than any of the animal proteins. I had 5,000 combinations. So I was a senior author on it because it was my study and I discovered it, but I also had a Dr. Hillard Fitzke who did the computer program to print out all these results, and Dr. Berman. I couldn't get it published. I sent it to the American Dietetic Association, to the USDA, Harvard, MIT, all the nutrition publications. In fact, no one would even comment on it. I didn't even get a rejection. It was as if there was this absolute terror, this fear. What if we had to acknowledge that our entire food pyramid was a fraud? What if we had to acknowledge that we're causing disease by encouraging people to eat certain food groups and in percentages that actually contributes to high blood pressure, elevation in cholesterol, etc.? Well, they would all look like idiots, which they were anyhow, and so they just didn't even acknowledge this truth existed. So probably the most important single nutritional discovery in protein was simply hid in the closet. It took 11 years before a peer-reviewed journal, Longevity, finally published it. In the interim, I published it in a book called The Egg Project. The reason it was called The Egg Project, because the most perfectly utilized form of protein was the egg, about 97%. But in this study, I showed that at least 3 combinations could exceed the egg in that protein utilization, go up to 99%. So in effect, we created a whole new scientific nutritional paradigm. Now, it didn't matter that truth was out. Nothing has ever changed from there to now. In fact, I got a call from the UN when the Egg Project came out, and this person said, I work at the UN. I'm responsible for helping countries that are in drought or food shortages with their food. And after looking at this, I see that we could advocate that they could grow certain grains and legumes together, and that could help substantially reduce their food starvation. Yeah, it could. Never had a meeting after that. I was later told that someone affiliated at the political level said, you're going to go up against the food cartels, the grain cartels, the dairy cartels. So anyhow, it's just one of many little stories and tidbits. But then I also saw, when I met with Senator McGovern's head of committee, he said the real reason we had the food pyramid the way it is because the special interest groups hire scientists who sit on the USDA's advisory panel on food nutrition, and they say we should have eggs and dairy and meat and pastas and white bread and sugar and with some fruits and vegetables thrown in. They're the ones who control it. So understand, it's all about money. It has nothing in the world to do about nutrition. And he said, that's the truth of it. So just so you know, that there is nothing that the federal government ever does that I would ever accept without challenge, because it lies and it's in the pocket and has been for a long time to the special interest groups. And we all know it. If you have a brain, you know that. And it's just a septic little cesspot of this. It's just a sick city. This whole environment within Washington is sick. These career bureaucrats and everybody looking out for themselves and no one caring about the American public. In any case, when it comes to nutrition. So what happened was that the Egg Project became a monster bestseller. And I remember just one lecture I did was over 1,300 people in a church just talking about this. So today, millions upon millions of Americans are turning vegetarian or meatless for different reasons. Some because of ethics. They don't want to see animals suffer. Some because of nutrition. They want to eat better and feel healthier. Some because of economics. It's just a lot less expensive to eat more natural foods. And we still haven't had that big turning yet. We haven't had the turning from a meat-based diet, animal protein diet, to a plant protein diet. My hope is that with this new feature film I'm finishing and bringing out in the next 12 months, and a book to go with it, that will change people's minds. In the interim, this is the latest, and I just read this morning. This is a very interesting article about Veggie World, Why Eating Greens Won't Save the Planet, by Bob Holmes. But after reading this article, he makes just the opposite argument. It's amazing. People read a headline and don't read the body. He talks about the hidden cost of meat, what we spend on meat, how much land is used for meat. Just a few figures I thought were interesting. The world consumed last year 280 million tons of meat, 700 million tons of milk, and 1.2 billion eggs, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. And of course, understand how bad this is. Only about 10% of what a grazing animal eats is converted into protein through nitrogen. That means 90% of what an animal eats is wasted. But 90% of what we grow in our major crops in America, soy and corn and soy, goes to these animals. Which means that 90% of what we grow and give to the animals is wasted. You realize then, if you do the simple math, that we could feed every single hungry person on the planet with what we waste in inefficient protein utilization and conversion in animals. Forget the methane that's released from the animals burping. Forget from the toxic water because of all the nitrogen and chemicals. Forget the growth stimulating hormones and antibiotics that are fed to the animals. Forget that the farm today is not the family farm of years ago that you or I may have grown up on or visited. Forget all that. I'm just talking about just basic, simple economics. Why in the world would you give 90% of what an animal is fed to the earth? You're not getting anything on the animal from that. That's pure unmitigated waste, and we could be eating that. Now, that was in this article here, and I thought that was very good. One more reason to be a vegetarian. Now, a new insight, if you're taking anti-cholesterol statin drugs, which I don't believe people should be doing because there's a lot of good ways to lower your cholesterol level through diet and nutrients, according to the American Chemical Society's journal Biochemistry, the side effect, this is from Science Daily, this is mainstream science, quote, scientists are reporting a possible explanation for the symptoms of anxiety and depression that occur in some patients taking the popular statin family of anti-cholesterol drugs and reported by some individuals on low cholesterol diets. The symptoms could result from low levels of cholesterol in the brain. Well, taking an anti-cholesterol statin drug and reducing cholesterol, which is a principal nutrient for the brain, creates an imbalance in dopamine, serotonin, and that can create both anxiety or depression, which can be misdiagnosed as bipolar. And now they want to give statin drugs to children. They also want to get healthy people to start taking these drugs to prevent disease. Anxiety may be at the root of religious extremism, researchers find, quote from Science Daily, Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Anxiety and uncertainty can cause us to become more idealistic and more radical in our religious beliefs. In a series of studies on 600 participants who were placed in an anxiety-provoking or neutral situations and then asked to describe their personal goals and rate their degree of conviction for their religious ideals, this included asking participants whether they would give their lives for their faith or support a war in its defense. Across all studies, anxious conditions caused participants to become more eagerly engaged in their ideals and extreme in their religious convictions. Think about that. Think of Mel Gibson when he was playing in Braveheart. You know, think of Robin Hood, this latest film. Think of every film you've seen where people are going to battle. Right? You never see him going, "All right, gang, let's all do a meditation. We're going to kill the enemy. You know? They're all, you know, air pumping swords or guns. Well, now we understand why these people have some kind of religious or mystical experience before they get themselves killed. God, how stupid. I'm Gary Null. Conversation for people who still have some brain cells left, right here on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay with us. Go to some calls after our guest, and my guest is coming up in a few minutes, Marilyn Hyman. We're going to talk about how we can do something in Congress that really helps we, the American people, clean up our environment and keep it clean and minimize the opportunity for these catastrophes in the Gulf to happen again. But joining us right now in our studio is our program director, Kara Lead. Hi, Kara.
Hi, Gary. How are you doing today?
Good.
You know, I just wanted to let our audience know at WPFW that we just found out that Gary has increased 300% in ratings. And I just wanted to thank everyone for listening. We realized from looking at some of the reports that it's a whole new audience of people tuning in and listening to your show. And it's the largest growth in audience that's ever been recorded, and we're really excited about it. I know as time has gone on at WPFW, and the days that you were on the station have dwindled. A lot of the audience went away. They tune on now at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, and a whole new audience has found you and started listening to your show, and in just the past 5 or 6 months, it has gone up 300%, and it's a record-setting amount for not only WPFW, but for all Pacifica stations. So congratulations, Gary.
Thank you. I was given a copy of the Arpatron ratings, and I was surprised. I've never experienced anything like that in my entire radio career, and I'm not aware that anyone else has either. And someone who cares about numbers, and that's one of my hobbies. I love numbers. I've always looked at all the ratings to see whose audiences are out there. How are they doing? And I was on PFW for 20 years, 5 days a week, and then for no particularly good reason, they took off the Friday show, and then they took off the Thursday show, and then 2 years ago, with no warning and no good reason, it was just one radicalized person at the station who had more power than 36,000 people in my audience. That's the politics of Pacifica. They took off my Wednesday show, and when they did that, I said, understand something. My audience is going to depart en masse. They did this at BAI. Because if you're not honoring the audience won't support the station. And that's exactly what happened. And the audience just tanked. But then the numbers picked up on Progressive Radio Network, so they didn't stop listening. They just stopped supporting the station. They went over to listen on PFW. And I told Ron Pinchback this at the time. I said, Ron, is this the choice you want to make? Allowing one radicalized, hate-filled person to have more power than the positive progressive minds that are there. Well, that's the way it is. Okay, fine. Understand that you're dealing in a real world, something that rarely occurs when you have communication with people in media. And then I noticed the difference in the emails I was getting, starting about a year ago. They weren't questions as much about health as about best places to live, people who are dropping out of either the conservative or liberal communities because they saw the myth. There's no more painful lesson in life than to wake up one day and realize that much of your life has been lived with myth. And if there's any message I could tell people, it's first each day, just give yourself a chance to sit quietly and reflect and ask, am I living a myth this day on any level? Let me just give you an example.
Sure.
I just got off a major radio debate just now to come down here to do this. I was upstairs in my office, and it was an Iowa radio station, which is very conservative. And But I was there to talk about an article I'd written called Death by Medicine, showing that American medicine was the number one reason people die each year in the United States. And on one of the points, a person says, well, you know, what would you do to change our system, our healthcare system? And I said, first realize that there is nothing about our healthcare system that's real. There's and reform, none. What do you mean? Well, will any American be healthier because of it? Are we going to prevent diseases? Heart disease, cancer, diabetes, real diseases that kill people, injure people? No. Are we going to have better treatment models instead of the ones that are completely quackery, like most chemotherapy for cancer, or statins, this whole, which only benefit the pharmaceutical industry? No, it'll stay the same. I said, no. I said, let's just say that you listen to Rush Limbaugh. I hope you don't, but let's say you do. All right?
I don't, if that helps.
Okay. I said, no. Let's say that Rush is right, that we should be against socialism. Let's just say he's right. Okay. All right. Rush, we're going to support you today in that as long as you are completely convinced and not hypocritical, where's it going to take us? Then we get to the myth. Rush, your house is burning down. I'm sorry. We can't call the fire department. What do you mean you can't call the fire department? That's socialism, Rush. Because they're going to put out anyone's fire without asking, do you have insurance to pay for this? Rush, I'm sorry, but there's some people that just entered your back door and they're going through your house, and if anyone's there, they're going to mug them, hurt them, maybe kill them. We can't call the police, Rush. That's socialism. Because those police are there to sacrifice their lives to help us. And they don't show preferential treatment. If you're poor or rich, they're still going to go there to do their job. You don't pay them for that. Oh, and by the way, Rush, you say you're against socialism, and let's say you're right. Then you got to be against the armed forces, the Navy, the Air Force, the Army, the Coast Guard, because that's all socialism. Rush, you went to a public school. I went to a public school. I like my public school education. I thought I got a great education. But that's now considered socialism. By the way, Rush, heaven forbid you should ever be, you know, in a car wreck, a train wreck, a plane wreck. Because when they come to pick you up to put you on a stretcher, if you don't have their insurance, they're going to have to leave you out there to rot. But because we have this system, they'll help you. But I can understand, Rush, if you're opposed to the socialism for Wall Street houses like Goldman Sachs. Oh, but you're not. That's the socialism you're for. You're against the big agri, the big genetically modified companies like Monsanto, and giving them $350 billion in farm subsidies and not giving the small, struggling organic farmer a penny. You're against that, aren't you, Rush? Damn, wrong again. You're for that big giveaway. Surely, Rush, you're against giving the pharmaceutical companies $300 billion a year to protect their profits, which are excessive. No, you support that too? Well, how about the exploitative insurance companies? How about the military-industrial complex that we know and can prove that 80% of all money spent on the military-industrial complex is wasted and worthless with duplicity and obsolescence and insider dealing and no-bid contracts, perpetual war state? You're against that waste, aren't you? Because it doesn't make it a safer world? Surely. No, that's the socialism you're for.
Socialism for the wealthy. Makes perfect sense.
So when you... But the whole point was that what we have today is we have conservatives living with the myth that they're against big government when they're not. They created big government. Wasteful government. And the liberals' myth is we need big government. What big government are you talking about? The bureaucracies where in the intelligence community you have 16 different agencies doing the same work and none of it helping us? They all missed all the important indicators? Are you Are you for big government when $500 million was given to New York State as stimulus and only 55 people were hired? $500 million, 55 people. It should have been 5,000 people hired. 55. That's waste. So both are living with myths. The liberals, we believe in the unions. No, you don't. Because you sold out the unions when Clinton sold out everyone for NAFTA and GATT. And you sold out the environment. And you sold out on all these important treaties. So when you look at the myth of what people have become, you see how little honesty a person is engaged in. So how in the world can you make it a better world for yourself or others if you're coming from a point of supporting myths instead of reality? So if you want to live an authentic life, then think authentic thoughts and act upon them. And if you take away an audience for political reasons and the audience doesn't support you or listen anymore, the myth is that somehow you've done the right thing. You have not. Now what we have is we have people coming to this show in phenomenal numbers, unheard of numbers, in one period, from winter to spring. Just a 322% increase. I've never heard of that in my career. In one book, what's called a book, winter, spring, summer, fall. There are actually three books here, winter, spring, and fall. Never heard of that. But then these are not the same people. These tend to be younger, more idealistic, and tired of the myths that somehow we have a left-right society, and when we don't, we have an up-and-down society. And where you're at on that up-and-down determines your ideology. So people want to hear a different discourse. They want to hear a different type of truth. And that's why those numbers are what they are. And I'm very pleased about this. And in fact, we just got a phone call today that looks like a major syndicate is going to take the show up on no commercials. Oh, on a commercial network.
Great.
Because the number, they've never seen numbers like that. But again, you have to get out of the myth. You have to hold principles at a level where you're not willing to compromise, even if something's going to go against you. If you know the truth and you're willing to act on it and you see others are not, when you begin to compromise on that truth, then you'll no longer know where the truth is. You'll just know where the compromise is. So everything you do will be an extension of compromise. And one day you'll wake up and there won't be any you there. There's no there. There's just a series of compromises that only benefit those in power and do not benefit the average person. And that's why the existing ideologies are now threatened, because people are going independent. And from the independent movement, there is a progressive movement. And it's not organized yet, but it's got the best minds in America. The Chris Hedges. The people who think and who are compassionate and who care and who will not allow any topic or any group to be excluded from consideration. It's one of inclusion, not exclusion. I hope that deals with the issue.
Thanks, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall, broadcasting from our studios in New York City. My guest, who I had introduced earlier at the beginning of the program, Marilyn Hyman, is the director of the Pew Environmental Group's Offshore Energy Program, a global environmental policy organization based in the U.S. and Canada and Europe and other nations. She has 27 years' experience on natural resources, on their policy and their issues. And she's testified before the Senate last month advocating for stronger public environmental protection and current offshore drilling laws. In the past, she served on the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Commission and has served as an advisor to former Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt. And she's now co-leading an initiative to push forward acts in the House and Senate that would force Congress to take decisive actions to prevent oil spills from happening in the future. Nice to have you with us today, Marilyn.
Oh, thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Marilyn, there are two issues that I would like to address. It's been over 30 years since Congress has amended an important offshore drilling legislation that would protect the environment in coastal regions and the residents who reside near or most are affected by offshore drilling rigs. Summarize for us the major flaws in the current oil drilling laws that have enabled British Petroleum, for example, to continue essentially unscathed from the current Gulf tragedy. Also, two additions to that. One is last week I saw people in Florida, in Panama City, on the news going into the water, lots of them. Why? Because the day before the tar balls had been taken off the beach and cleaned up out of the water. And I told my audience, I said, the logic of going into water after tar balls have been removed, with the assumption that that water is clean, is no different than if you went to a full toilet, took out the excrement, and then said, okay, kid, have yourself a glass of clean water. It's amazing to me, as a scientist and as a journalist, an activist, that we do not think the public will think on these issues and assume that they can continue to breathe the air without any problem and deny that it's toxic, that we can continue to use these waters as if there's not a contaminant factor. And the last issue that I'd like for you to address is that who owns the Gulf of Mexico? Who has the right to go out into the Gulf? From international laws that I have looked at, British Petroleum does not have the right to curtail people from being, including scientists, from exploring the bottom of the Gulf, the floor, to see if there are other cracks or openings that are extruding methane or oil, and yet they have had the power to arrest individuals with massive fines and imprisonment if they took photos that they didn't want to get information that should have been public domain, and yet our government enabled British Petroleum to harass and intimidate legitimate journalists, activists, and others from getting more information. I'd like for you to address all these issues, please.
Sure. Gary, you bring up a lot of good points. Let me just start with the flaws in the laws that may have led to this disaster happening. I think you're right that legislation hasn't been changed in 32 years, but those of you who have been around for a while remember James Watt, and he created the Minerals Management Service through an executive order or an administrative order. It was not created by Congress. It was not the position, the director of the Minerals Management Service was not appointed by the president like the Fish and Wildlife Service director is, or the Park Service or the Forest Service. Kind of was an agency that operated under the radar screen, and it actually was operating in a way that let industry self-regulate itself. And there's been a lot of problems that we've heard about the Minerals Management Service, about the culture, about the way they've overseen the industry, not even just not doing the job, but actually in a corrupt way, allowing the industry to get away with whatever they wanted to get away with. Well, that lax management, I think, was one of the key reasons we are dealing with this rig that has blown up, killed 11 people, and is destroying the Gulf of Mexico. So it's been 32 years since changes in the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, and that act sets up the process for drilling. There's a five-year planning process that determines where the leases will occur. Then the leasing happens, then the exploration, which includes seismic, and then the production. And that those phases have the law right now does not really focus on environmental protection. It focuses on expeditious development, and those some of the changes in the laws deal with that problem, the fact that the environment is not protected and not considered as drilling decisions are being made. As you know, there was a moratorium off of the coast for many years that even the first President Bush had supported and actually put into administrative action as well as legislative, that even though the Congress had adopted it. So when Bush 2 started getting going and the Cheney Task Force was making decisions about drilling, they, you know, started saying we need to lift this moratorium, and they went into the Arctic Ocean, which is another area where I work a lot on, and said we need to drill here. Well, if you think that hurricanes are extreme, the Arctic Ocean is an extremely rough, remote place with darkness and ice on the ocean, and you know, a lot of incredibly sensitive marine mammals. And so the Bush administration, last administration, was very pro-drilling, and this Minerals Management Service, who had already been lax in oversight, became very, very proactive and an advocacy entity. And so I think that I can go over more of the reforms with you of what the new bills are proposing, but let me just answer a couple of the other questions you asked. As far as the tar balls and the oil, as you mentioned, I was a staff member of the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Commission after the Exxon Valdez, and we watched the fisheries get shut down. I mean, I could predict, you know, exactly where things were headed just because of my experience with the Exxon Valdez. So many people's lives have been so badly affected by this spill. The people who their livelihoods are affected, people who lost family members, but the environmental damage is incredible, what you can see and what you cannot see. And that's, I think, what you were talking about with the tar balls. We just don't know yet what the environmental impacts are. And if you have tar balls, that may be an indication that it's just some of the tar balls washing up. It also might be an indication that that water has remnants and is contaminated with hydrocarbons. And polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons are very toxic, as we learned in the Exxon Valdez. We are still having re-oiling and impacts to wildlife in the Exxon Valdez, in the Prince William Sound area where the Exxon Valdez oil spill was. And so, you know, it cannot be taken for granted that that water is clean. And, you know, we need to make sure that we're very smart, because there are places and people want to make sure that the economy still does well in Florida and that people go and enjoy the beautiful beach. But we also want to make sure people are protected. And so the more monitoring that we have, the better off we'll all be. And that's what's going on now with the oil spill. There are many agencies that are involved in monitoring the oil spill. NOAA, National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, and the Environmental Protection Agency are doing some of this monitoring, and FDA on the, is it right, the FDA and whatever, whoever monitors the fish, there's a lot of work being done, but more needs to be done, and especially in assessing what those damages are so that we can get the full amount from the industry, what they owe, what BP owes. And that's one of the provisions of the bill, to eliminate the liability cap. And one of the things I like to say is that, you know, if you don't eliminate the liability cap, you'll end up where we were at the Exxon Valdez oil spill, where 20 years later, case has gone to the Supreme Court, and people are getting pennies on the dollar, and some of these people have already died. The time has gone by, so, you know, so much. So, you know, we have to make sure things like the liability is not limited. We cannot socialize the risks and the costs to the people in the environment and privatize the profits for the industry, and that's why, you know, that liability cap elimination is so important. And then one of the things that you asked about was who owns the Gulf of Mexico. And in the outer continental shelf, Americans own the oil and they own the water. This is not owned by the industry. They have a right to drill. They earn a right to drill when they pay for their lease sale, but they do not own it. Any oil that comes out of it is owned by the American public, and any work that they're doing is done on American, in the outer continental shelf, on those lands, and those are our lands. And, I'm not familiar with some of these, the imprisonment and that you were talking about, but I did read an article that talked about thousands of abandoned wells, and I think you were referring to this.
27,000.
Yeah, wow, 27,000 abandoned wells. I haven't looked at the article lately. And one of the bills, I can't remember the number, actually deals with those abandoned wells. And oh, it's the Senate Commerce Bill that gives NOAA the authority to go and the funding to go look at those abandoned wells and determine if there is danger to the environment and figure out a plan about what needs to get done.
Good. Well, these are the issues that are important. Give us where people can go and look at these bills so they can read them, become aware of them, and then support those that they believe are important to support.
Great. Well, we are very strong about we need to plug the leaks in the law. It's really important that Congress take action this week before the recess. What I'm concerned about is that time will go by, this will become a memory in people's minds, and other issues will take precedent. And it's time right now to ensure that we don't have spills like this in the future and that we're very cautious and careful and have the science and the technology and the research to do these things in the future and make sure that the oversight is there, the safety is there, and the spill response capability is there. And I think that's what these bills really do, and it's an excellent package. Our website is www.pewenvironment.org /offshore energy reform. And you can call your senator or member of Congress at the Capitol switchboard by calling 202-224-3121. That's 202-224-3121, and let your member of Congress or your senator know how important it is to restore the Gulf, to put the money in, to eliminate this liability cap, to pass these oil spill bills that will help to ensure that we have better oversight and we don't allow this type of thing to happen in the future.
Marilyn Hyman, thank you very much for your good work, and we look forward to another conversation.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment, we're going to be taking your calls at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Please stay with us.
Girl, try to remember when we didn't have no shoes. We stuck together, just me and you. It took a long time to get what we got today. Now you want to give it all up.
I'd like to welcome you. It's your opportunity to call in now. Let's see who we have on the line. I don't see any names there. Need to know who I'm speaking with and where you're calling from. If you could just give, please, your name and the town or city, that's always important. And I'll be happy to address the issues. You can share your thoughts or questions or comments at 888-874-4888. Let's say hello to Rodney from Washington, D.C. Hi, Rodney. Rodney, speak up, please. Hi, you're on the air, Rodney.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Look, could you expound for us why the old Office of Technology Assessment was abolished under three successive presidents, namely the first Bush, Clinton, and then, Reagan, excuse me, the first Bush, and then Clinton finished it off around 1993, 95.
Okay, first a little
that,
back.
That would have precluded this oil situation because there are a number of white papers that exist dealing with minerals management, dealing with offshore drilling, dealing with the Gulf of Mexico in particular. And this is back in the early 80s.
I agree. Here is the point. At one time, we had what was called the Office of Technology Management or Technology Assessment. One of the most important studies that they ever presented was to show that 50% of the pharmaceutical drugs that were FDA approved in one 10-year period had to be recalled because they were so dangerous, either recalled or relabeled. We wouldn't have known about how dangerous they were, nor would they have been given the type of focus, but it was for this Office of Technology Assessment. Very similar in some regards to the General Accounting Office. But they dealt with every form of scientific or engineering issue. They also would have told you which pesticides were dangerous, which products were dangerous, and we would have had some checks and balances. So the idea was that the Reagan administration, you are correct, started it, and it was really the capstone was Clinton, because Clinton was coming in acting as if he was a liberal Democrat. He was a right of center corporatist. Every single thing he's ever done in his life, including in Haiti now, is what we call crisis capitalism. Let's exploit this. So, this man, and you know what's amazing, is that he's gotten away with this, and all this time because the myth that the liberals and Democrats say, oh, he's one of us. No, he isn't. You know, you don't hang with his people. You don't eat with his people.
How about this one, Gary? The fact that he was purportedly. Parenthetically, the first black president. Could you think of anything more asinine?
Well, he was a black president, wasn't he?
A black president?
No idea. Every time he'd be catching someone down their knees with him, he'd go off to a black Baptist church and say, "Oh God, save me, Jesus!"
Right.
They'd all say, "Oh, we love you, Bill." You know, and then he'd go back out and do it again. The point is,
and he would encourage them to invest in the prison industrial complex with their church dollars, and they would get a double return on it, right?
And also he was the one who got NAFTA. He was the one who got GATT. He was the one who supported the World Health Organization. He was the one who, without realizing the potential, Reagan opened the doors to China, but it was under Clinton that the largest single exportation of American jobs went to other countries. It's still in full swing. So that's what is always the irony when you go to a Walmart and buy a product that was made in China, frequently under repressed labor, that at one time it had been made with gainful labor in the United States. And this whole idea of buy a cheap bite at Walmart and stampede and kill someone in the process if it's a holiday, which they did this past year, just to get some cheap product that's made from China, and this shows you how we're dumbing down. In any case, the Office of Technology Assessment was the one barrier. Why? Because it was non-aligned politically. It was really independent. Secondly, it could call upon the finest scientific minds in the world, not just the United States. Thirdly, if there was a debate over, at the beginning of the show, I told you about how I discovered in the lab at the Institute of Applied Biology that all vegetables, grains, legumes, and nuts and seeds contain
They even had people in evaluating mass transit.
Yes, they did. But I discovered that you didn't have to eat an animal protein to get all your amino acids. We've been lied to. If that were the case today, the Office of Technology Assessment would have taken that report, been able to analyze it and say yes, and would have made an issue of it. But I had no connections. I had no door openers. I had no one in a position of power to do that. Now, that's why the Office of Technology Assessment would have been like a consumer report on all issues of importance to us technically. We would be a safer country today. We would be a healthier country today. And we wouldn't have had this exploitation. We need to bring back the Office of Technology Assessment. And by the way, its budget was minuscule. It had a very small budget.
Right. Well, actually, the Princeton University has a repository online and a big initiative to try to reinstate that office. But the thing of it is that, you know, it was so horrible that the OTA had, you know, a minuscule budget, but it was a political move, wouldn't you say, in line with what you always talk about, politics over substance.
That's correct, and we have to stop listening to the left and right, realizing that it was only politics and not substance.
It was like Ralph Nader inside the Beltway, right, Gary?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. Thank you.
Rodney, thank you very much.
All right.
Let's say hello to John from New York City. Hi, John.
Hey, Gary. This is John Q.
Yeah, John.
This thing in the newspaper about this kid that killed his family and then set fire to the house.
No, the kid did not kill the family. The mother killed the family. There was no smoke in the lungs of the three children. That meant that the mother slit their throats with a razor. My suggestion is this: we should ask the New York coroner, do an autopsy that sees was there any psychotropic medication, was there any anti-anxiety or like Paxil, Prozac, any of these psychiatric medications in her blood. I think that's very important to know that. We got to run because I only got 2 minutes. David from Arizona. Hi, David.
Hi, Gary. As a single person, my question is, no kids. What would be your choice in the western U.S.? No snow, no extreme heat, western United States, single person, 40s. What would be your top picks for locations?
Sedona, Arizona. Austin, Texas. Those would be my one and two favorite. For single people who want the moderate climates and aesthetic beauty, because there's two of the most beautiful places in the United States. And I'll stop with those two until my report is complete. I have a report coming out on this on the website. By the way, for everyone, I'm putting up a new article and a new documentary, part two, today, probably in the next hour or so, on United States government to our Gulf War vets drop dead, part two. More interviews, more article, and I want to thank the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, who have gone there to look at it and pass it on. Pass it on. It's on YouTube, Gary Nall YouTube, and it's on the Gulf War, homeless Gulf War vets. It's my desire to help these homeless Gulf vets, and making Americans aware of their plight is the first step. And how many of them are there? Try 800,000 in a year. We're out of time. I'll see you tomorrow. Have a nice day.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Carol Lee.